Hey, all, this is Sean Gerber. Thank you for listening today. But before we get started, I have a couple of questions for you. Are you caught in the daunting maze of CISSP preparation, unable to find your way forward? That's precisely where I found myself when I began studying for the CISSP. Overwhelmed would be an understatement. There are now an ocean of CISSP training programs available, and are you unsure which ones to trust? I remember the struggle, but there was nothing accessible to me outside of the pricey boot camps. And that's precisely why CISSP Cyber Training came into existence, to illuminate your pathway towards acing the CISSP exam. At CISSP Cyber Training, I've forged the CISSP blueprint into a step-by-step guide to navigate you through the intricacies of the CISSP journey, designed to provide you the direction and guidance you need to pass the CISSP exam confidently. But don't just take my word for it. Listen to what one of my students, Kevin Fallon, had to say about the CISSP blueprint. This is precisely what I needed in your course, direction. The blueprint is the perfect roadmap to stay on track. I appreciate its clarity and tangible sense of progress it brings. A phenomenal tool for revision. And then there was another from Christopher Wagstaff. Sean Gerber, your guidance was invaluable throughout the CISSP study and certification process. Thank you for breaking the monotony. Once you've wrapped up with the podcast, make your next stop CISSPcybertraining.com and let's together turn the tide in your favor, meeting your CISSP goals and catapulting your career in cybersecurity. Now, without further ado, let's get going. Giddy up. Welcome to the CISSP Cyber Training Podcast, where we provide you the training and tools you need to pass the CISSP exam the first time. Hi, my name is Sean Gerber, and I'm your host for this action-packed, informative podcast. Join me each week as I provide the information you need to pass the CISSP exam and grow your cybersecurity knowledge. All right, let's get started. Let's go. Hey, all, Sean Gerber with CISSP Cyber Training, and today is a beautiful day here in Wichita, Kansas. Hope you all are having a wonderful day wherever you might be around the globe. I know there's a lot of crazy things going on around the world, especially as it relates to these fires that have been hitting into Greece. So hopefully you all, if you're in that area, you are safe, because it's crazy how hot it is this summer. It's just been a very, very warm summer. Well, today we are going to be talking about identity and access management. This can get a bit crazy and a bit confusing, so we're going to try to break it down into a way that is hopefully digestible and understandable by you all, because it can be a bit challenging at times. I know I even get confused when I start walking through these. What does each of these things mean? And so therefore, we're just going to kind of go through and see how it relates to the CISSP. There's some key concepts you're going to have to know for the CISSP around identity and access management. Now, you can dive deep into this and get extremely technical, which can be problematic as it relates to the CISSP. Again, as we talk about that exam, one thing you want to keep in mind is that this is designed for managers or senior level people within an organization. So like people like me, right? So I'm a chief information security officer with a large company. As a chief information security officer, I deal with the high level aspects of it. I don't necessarily get down in the weeds. I do have to understand those specific topics, but I do not understand the real high technical pieces of this. So that's a bit of a challenge that people have to work through. And so we're going to try to get into that. We're going to get into those concepts, but we're going to get into it in a way, hopefully, that you will be able to understand it and then utilize it on the exam that you'll be taking soon. So that is the ultimate goal. Okay, so today we're going to talk about some three main topics: identity management, federated identity management, and then the credential management system. Now, you might have been seeing stuff about a credential management system in the news recently with Microsoft, and that the compromise of their CMS to gain access to various pieces within Microsoft 365. It looks pretty interesting to see how that's going to play out. That's a pretty big deal if their CMS was compromised. So, and also keep in mind, a CMS is used in many different ways. You'll use it in AWS. You use it in this case as it relates to identity and access management. It's just a term that deals with storing of the credentials. So don't glob on to the fact that if you have a CMS in AWS, well, there it's the exact same CMS that's used within your identity provider. They are not. They are, the terms are used interchangeably, but the systems are different. Okay, so let's get into what is identity management. Now, as it relates to identity management, it is known to basically as identity and access management. Depending upon where you go, and depending on, I hear people talk and they mention AWS and IAM and they go, that's like a dirty word. I don't quite totally understand that, but I basically know that IAM is used primarily throughout the environment or involved throughout the security space as identity and access management. And you will see that on the exam that that's what they're going to be referring to. Now, it's a process of identifying, authenticating, and authorizing individuals or potentially even groups of people to have access to applications, systems, or even networks. So it's the way that it's the keys that allow people into an environment. Now, these can be associated with user rights or they can be established identities that were created through another method or means. So it's the ultimate goal is just the identity to prove who you are to get allow you in and access to these systems. Now, identity management does include a lot of processes and technologies to make this happen. And the processes are designed and the technologies as well to help make your overall experience much easier, much better, right? One of the things that you don't want to run into, it's awesome where you can have the least amount of barriers when you go and you log into a system. You log in one time and then it carries those tokens, it carries that knowledge of you into other applications. That is the seamless experience that people want. They don't want to go, okay, I log into my application A. Great, takes my password. Then I log into application B, it takes my password. Application C, and so on and so forth. They don't want that. They want to have the ability to log into one system and then that information is stored and then carries with you as you log into various other applications throughout the internet. And that is the new identity and access piece that has come up. And it's now you'll see, we'll talk about some of the technologies that allow that to occur. But that is what people expect to have happen. So as you're looking from a CISSP standpoint, know that your customers, that is what they're going to want. And so therefore, you need to understand how do those various technologies work because you need to educate leaders on putting those technologies within your company. As an example, I've worked with a small company in the past, and this company had a situation where they didn't have any sort of multi-factor or single sign-on put in place. And it was the CISO's responsibility to help educate them in a way that would benefit them, one, from a security standpoint, but also from a point of view where the employees would enjoy something like that, right? They don't have to have those various barriers to gain access. So that's the security person's responsibility. And we talk about it in the CISSP. It's not just taking a test. It's about influencing people and helping them understand the security mechanisms, but also ways to help them understand the technology in a way that can make their lives better and easier. Now, there's some primary components as it relates to identity management. One, you have users, systems, policies, and procedures. These are the primary components that are tied to this. Now, users, these are individuals who need to access the network or their applications or the data. These are the individuals that gain access to this. Could be an employee, could be contractors, could be partners, could be just pretty much anybody. And they have been given a unique user ID that allows them specific rights and privileges within your environment. So this can be set up automated. It can be you have a person that just automatically or that creates an account for each person when they start. It can be done different ways. So, but the user is the person who gains access to the data. Then you have systems. Now, this includes your hardware, your software, even your network infrastructure that needs some level of authentication and access control to gain access to these same very applications that the users are using. Now, it can include databases, applications, file servers, cloud services, you name it. They can pretty much have anything. And you're going to want to understand that users and systems, they do work, they do need the same types of accounts. Now, they, as you get down the path of allowing them access, you understand that systems and users may have varying differing needs, but they both are going to need some level of access inside your environment. Now, policies. Policies are the rules. We talk about what is a policy. When I first started in working on my CISSP, I didn't understand what a policy was. I thought it was a bunch of politicians putting together some draft documentation, and these were the policies that you followed. And in reality, those are the same, but in the security world, they're a little bit different. In the fact that these are the rules that help dictate who can access the resources and when. So as an example, say you have a policy around an administrator. So you have a local, you have people that have administrator access. And I have a policy that says if you have local admin, you are allowed only access to the device in which you are logging into. Now, if I say that, then those are the rules in which I have to operate, which then in turn works with the network people to ensure that these accounts have access only to the system that I'm working on. Versus if I have local admin and I just make it a wide group, I could have be local admin on every device. And that would be a very different policy than if I said I need to have local admin on only the device I'm logged into. So there, those are key pieces to keep in mind. Now, again, these can be, include password complexity, frequency of password changes. They can also be basically for granting, modifying, and revoking access. So all of those are tied to policies. Now, procedures, these are the steps that are taken to enforce these policies. So these are the steps you must go through, right, to gain access. So this could be a user access capability. It could be the monitoring aspects of it. It could be the auditing piece of this or the assessment piece. It could be the procedures in dealing with an overall incident. How would you handle those? So again, the primary components are users, systems, policies, and procedures. And if you keep those in mind and try to keep it as simple as you possibly can, as it relates to identity and access management, if you do that, it'll make your life a whole lot easier. And it will also make it easy to communicate with others around what you're actually asking for. Now, what are some of the benefits of implementing identity and access management within your organization? So we've got really six areas that we're going to kind of roll through. And each of these are a very important factor of why you should implement IDM within an organization. Now, the also when you're deploying identity and access management within your company, keep in mind that you don't have to necessarily go to the largest possible deployment you can, where you all have Ping identity, there is limited login capability. If that is where your goal is, how do you then migrate to get to that position? And so don't just think, well, I've got to do all of these things between multi-factor and single sign-on. I got to put it all in place. And you do, it's highly recommended that you do implement these. And they have a lot of really easy tools to help you do this within a small company or within even medium-sized companies. But there's a lot of great tools to help you integrate that within your environment. But don't get so focused on how big this is and how hard it is. You need to just focus on what is one step I can do this year or the next 6 months that can move me down this identity and access management path. That it's the important thing to keep in mind around security is if you try to look at this from a holistic standpoint, it can become very overwhelming. So it is important that you take this in a step-by-step approach. Okay, so some of the benefits of implementing this within your company is security, right? So we just talked about that, and you're listening to the CISSP Cyber Training Podcast, and so you are trying to study for your CISSP, which ties to security. So guess what? It's one of the most important pieces, right? So by managing user access, you can ensure that only the authorized users or individuals have the access to the most sensitive data within your company. And this will reduce the risk of breaches, incidents, and so forth. So having this in place is like a safety blanket. It really does work. When we didn't have identity and access management in place in various companies I've worked with, even through the military, it caused a lot of drama. There's a lot of churn that went into place. But once we got a good provider that dealt with identity and access management, it became very simple. And the responses or the service desk calls, the tickets that came in were much reduced because of the fact that we put in an identity and access provider. Now, this is especially important, especially when we're dealing with this world that we live in, where the security and cyber threats are completely sophisticated, are becoming more and more sophisticated. It's just, you got to do it. So again, you're here to study for your CISSP, but you will graduate. You will get pass your certificate. And when you get that, you are going to move on to a small company. So something to really keep in mind about employing identity and access management. Productivity, again, it can dramatically increase the speed in which you can be giving users access to the systems and the data they need, and it will make people happy. Now, the challenge that comes out of this is a bit of a challenge, which we'll probably get into down the road a little bit, is that it becomes so easy that when it does break, users scream. So it is important to keep that in mind. It works very, very well, and users come to expect it. But when it does have challenges, it can be very detrimental to your organization. Automated processes, this is another thing when it comes to productivity-wise. It allows for automated processes to basically streamline your onboarding and offboarding of users. So you have individuals who leave your company and they exit, right? So when they exit, how do you remove those credentials quickly? That's always been a challenge. You'll see this a lot within a company. You'll go to this company, you'll pass your CISSP, you'll go there, and you'll have all these great plans to be able to go make a change, and you'll look at the blocking and tackling. We talked that as the basics of security, and you'll see that Billy Bob, George, Fred, Yi Ching, whoever you may have within your company, wherever you may be, was a contractor 3 years ago, and that contractor is no longer in the system. That contractor is no longer working. Well, guess what? That contractor's activity is still there. So that's a bad thing, right? So you want to make sure that you have have this in place, because it helps removing users that have been there for a while, and it helps reduce the burdens on your IT department. We talked about the user experience with use of single sign-on. It is something that people love. And once you put it in place, they will assume it is the standard. And if it breaks or goes away, they will not be happy with you. It also improves the user experience, but it also reduces the chance of password-related security incidents. It does, so that now people are they are reusing passwords. It helps reduce some of that challenge as well. Compliance, again, many industries do have regulations that require companies to have some level of control around the access. And so this will help dramatically to reduce your compliance burden that you may have. This can, when you're dealing with putting this in place, especially when you're dealing with regulated environments, let's just say you're dealing with CMMC for the U.S. government, and they are asking for that specific topic, this will help dramatically reduce your risk, and it'll also help show that you have met the compliance requirements around it. Cost savings, obviously, by automating these processes, it can cost a little bit coming up front, but by not having individuals to do this manually, and then also by avoiding errors, it will give you a very substantial cost savings in the future. It's worth every penny that you spend on it. It's just sometimes it's hard to justify that at the beginning if you don't have all of that outlined. And then auditability. Basically, it allows individuals to come into your organization either through third parties or internal audits, and then be able to determine who had access to what resources, when they did, and so forth. I had a situation a few years back where a system went down and it dealt with the auditing capability within SAP or within an ERP environment. And that can be a problem, right? So it allows people access to an environment. But auditors use those. Well, this is a great way of having single sign-on that will allow auditors to see when people logged in and when they logged out. So now I'm going to get into this identity and access management systems and the technology that's associated with it. So we're going to talk just mainly about three different areas. Single sign-on, which is also called SSO, multi-factor authentication, or MFA, that's Mike Foxtrot Alpha, and then biometric authentication. So now, single sign-on, what exactly is that? Well, what it is it's a session in the user authentication service that permits a user to basically have one set of login credentials, a name and password. You'll see this when you go into some of the social media sites, that it will say log in using Facebook credentials, or log in with Google, or with whatever provider you may have. And if you log in with that, it takes that the normal login credentials you'd have with Google, and it applies them to the application you're logging into. And it basically, it allows the end user for all those applications that have been given rights to, and then it eliminates any further prompts when you try to log in. So it's just single sign on. You single time, you sign on, and it gives you the access to this. Again, I've got some, if you look at the videos, you'll see the videos on YouTube, and if you through CISSP Cyber Training, I have those videos as well. One of the use cases it talks about, it's on the screen, is how a large corporation with numerous internal and external services wants to streamline the login process, right? So you have multiple things in place, multiple applications that you use. You then would implement SSO, and now you go to your workstation on one morning, you log in, and then when you log in, it allows you access to these various applications and databases and whatever else within your organization. It's very good. People love it. Your employees will thank you for it. Actually, they probably won't, because what ends up happening is once you put it in place, they just assume that that's just part of the deal. Now, multi-factor authentication, or also known as MFA. Multi-factor authentication is basically a security mechanism that requires basically one method of authentication from independent categories of credentials, right? So one, it basically is designed to create a layered defense or a layered approach to identity and access management. So we got a situation, let's just use, most people have banking credentials. You have a username and password that allows you to log into your bank. When you log into your bank and it says Sean Gerber at blank, here's your password, you know, QWERTY, yeah, Q-W-E-R-T, 123456, that's your password. Okay, if you're listening to this and you're a CISSP, that's a really bad password. But let's just use that that's your password for today. So your QWERTY, you put your password in. The moment you log in, then it's going to ask for another form of authentication. Now, this is can be done in multiple different ways. It can be done through a physical location. It can be, as an example, where it knows that by you're in this physical building, you have access to it, it'll allow you in that way. It could be set up to where you have a PIN that you have to enter that would be part of something that you know in your mind and that you're going to have to put it out there. It could also be something that you are, i.e. biometrics or a fingerprint that would allow you access, but it's another layered defense that's going to help mitigate the issues of people trying to steal your credentials. Now, the one thing you want to watch out for when it comes to MFA, now as a CISSP, multi-factor is something you really need to push to ensure that it goes in place with whatever company you go to. But one thing you want to keep in mind is getting MFA information on SMS, which is basically your texting. It's a simple messaging service. If you get a text that says, here's your PIN, that is not the most efficient or the most secure way of getting that information you need to act as a multi-factor layer. It's used all the time. It's used everywhere. But it's not one of the better solutions to use. Ideally, you'd want to use a different type of authentication. So when you're dealing with authentication, I kind of alluded to it earlier, but you want to focus on something there's the three things that we focus on. Something you know, something you have, and something you are. Now, something you know would be obviously a PIN, right? Do you know that PIN? Maybe your PIN is a four-digit PIN that you enter in. I know at Netflix, because my kids get into stuff they shouldn't get into, I put in a PIN to go into Netflix. So you can log into my account. If you don't know my PIN, you ain't getting into Netflix. So that is something that I know. When it comes to something that I have is there's on your phone, you can get an authentication application. Google has it. Microsoft has it. Various other companies have these authentication applications. It does a time sync to the application in the cloud so that if I log into your password provider, for an example, you log into your password provider and you enter in your username, your password, it then prompts you for an authentication mechanism. You go to your app that's on your phone or your computer, wherever you may have it, and then you, as it's rotating through this code, you then take that code and you place it inside the application. It syncs with the application in the cloud. It says, yes, Sean is that person because it's something he has. Allow Sean in. And so that's something you have. Then we get into the something you are piece of this is you get a text from your bank saying, hey, we see someone is trying to log in, please use your device and multi-factor and log into your bank. And so you can use the face ID or you can use your thumb on your biometrics. They're getting into now retina scans and so forth. So there's lots of ways for you to get some level of authentication into your environment. But multi-factor authentication is just another layer that you will go through to allow you access to the application or the database or whatever it might be that you're going into. The next one is biometric authentication. Now, biometric authentication is a security process that relies on unique biological characteristics of the individual, right? Fingerprint, eyeball, face, something like that. Now, when you're dealing with, depending upon the level of security where you're going, you may implement these biometrics in to gain access. In the military, we had various biometrics to gain access into specific locations. Challenges is they worked really well. Sometimes they didn't work at all. So you have to define which one is the best for you and your company. Is it something as simple as a fingerprint, or do you have to have a retina scan? There's various pieces around this. But bottom line is that they use these to gain authentication to systems and to various applications around there. So you need to kind of keep in mind, when would you use this? And when they're asking you questions on the CISSP, where are those types of questions that you would use? Okay, so we're going to roll into Federated Identity Management, or known as FIM. Okay, so what exactly is FIM? Well, FIM is going to be, it happens in various health sectors to include healthcare, education, government, you name it. And what it's done to do, it didn't make any sense at all. What its purpose is to help increase productivity, convenience, and then also allowing for administrative overhead to be reduced dramatically. Now, when you're dealing with FIM, there are some various protocols that you're going to be focused on. And you'll see these in the CISSP exam. And these are something you need to be aware of and how to deal with them. Now, we're going to talk about SAML, OAuth 2, and OpenID Connect. Now, what is SAML? It's not a camel, it's SAML, right? So a camel, if you're someplace other than Kansas, that's an animal that has a hump on top, maybe two humps, and has very long legs, and it's usually in very hot locations. But that's a camel. We're talking about SAML. So SAML is Security Assertion Markup Language. Now, this is an open standard for authentication, right? It exchanges authentication and authorization data between parties. And you're going to want to understand the differences of these and why we want to use those. It will basically transfers data between the identity provider, which you'll normally see an acronym called IDP, which is India Delta Papa. An IDP provider, and that's used a lot in the commercial spaces for what an identity provider is, but you need to understand that that is an important factor in your overall identity and access management plan. And then so it basically talks between the IDP and the service provider, or the SP. It does allow you to log into multiple services like web applications using a single set of credentials. So that is the purpose of SAML. One of the things that I deal with is when I'm looking at security assessments, if I'm dealing with an application that utilizes SAML, that is an important factor. If this application that I'm working with does not utilize SAML or OAuth2, then I would look down upon that application. Because in most places today, from a security assessment standpoint, you do want SAML to be used. You want that information. You would like an application because it works and it integrates well within your organization. So SAML is an important factor. Now, if this works by passing information about a user between identity provider and the service provider in what they call SAML assertions. Okay, so the IDP, the identity provider, will send an assertion to the service provider when the user tries to log in. Okay, so that sends that to the SP. This includes information about users such as name or username, email address, something along those lines. It does not include anything that is sensitive. It's only those key aspects that it would be as a person to allow them to log in. Okay, now that's a key factor because you're gonna see questions in the CISSP that may ask you around that they may send secure the username's password. That is not the username's password. Is not sent through a SAML assertion. Okay, so it's important to keep that in mind. This is when you're dealing with any sort of credentials that is outside of the SAML aspect. OAuth 2, this is a protocol that allows applications to request access on the user's behalf without getting the password. Okay, very similar, right? So you got SAML and you got OAuth 2. This will allow one application the ability to access data from another application. Now this one in OAuth 2 will grant a token. So you got assertions and you got tokens. So those are key terms that you're going to see the difference between them. This token gives the application a certain level of access to the user's data in the application. So that's the OAuth piece of this. Whereas the assertion is sending out information such as your email, username, and so forth, the OAuth is using a token that which grants the access to the user's data. A lot of times OAuth will be used in applications such as APIs, which will be tied to the individual's username. One thing you want to avoid, obviously, with APIs is adding credentials into the API, hard coding that into the API. Don't do that. If you can avoid that at all costs, it would be. You can't always get away from that. Sometimes you have to implement the credentials into the API depending upon the application you're using, but try to avoid that at all costs. So an example you can basically be is around a user wants to gain access to, let's say, Google Calendar. The user doesn't give the third-party application their Google username, right? You don't want to give them that, but instead you authorize the application with Google to basically work between the calendars. So you're not giving them the username, but you're saying, hey, Google Calendar, you can work with this application, and then they sync up together. So you have OAuth, and then you have SAML. SAML deals with the credentials and assertions. OAuth deals more with the tokens and the application talking and gaining access to data. Now, OpenID Connect is an authentication standard built on top of OAuth 2. Now, so we got, again, so don't think of OpenID as its own protocol in that regard. It works in conjunction with OAuth 2. Now, it's built on top of OAuth 2, and it does allow the application to verify the identity of the user based on the authentication performed by the authorization server. Now, this is done by returning an ID token along with the access token. Like we mentioned, tokens tied to OAuth, assertions tied to SAML. So those are key. I've said it a couple times, so hopefully you pick up on that. So the ID token contains a list of user attributes. They call these claims. So you got claims, you got tokens, and you got assertions. Again, more terms, getting confusing. These include information about the identity, such as their name, email address, and so forth. So this gives OAuth that SAML capability, lack of a better way of kind of explaining that. Now, these claims are digitally signed by the authorization server and can be verified by the client. Okay, so how does this work? So we'll give you an example around this. You have a user that logs into a mobile app using your Google account. The app then sends the user to Google. Right? This has happened numerous times to me. Right? It happens all the time. Right? This is where they log in and they authorize the overall app. Then Google will send the app and the ID token with the claims. Right? So claims is OpenID Connect about the user's identity and the access token that the app can use to engage Google's API on behalf of the user. So you can kind of break that down a little bit. Is the fact that it's allowing you get access to Google's API with using your credentials, but that's the credentials you have are tied to OpenID. Now, what complicates this again even more is the fact that these protocols can be used independently, but they're often used together. For example, you may get OAuth 2 is often used with SAML or OpenID Connect to provide both authentication and authorization. So you're just going to have to, when they ask a question on the CISSP, parse that down. And I would recommend that if you don't have a good understanding of this, get smart on it. Because there's a lot of questions that are around SAML and OpenID from what I've been told. And I think because it can be confusing, it's one of those areas where they will focus on because it's confusing. And they kind of want to trip you up. They don't want to trip you up. They just want to make sure you know what you're talking about. Okay, so the credential management system, what is a CMS? This is a system designed to manage user credentials, including creation, issuance, and revocations of the access rights. Now, they can be a very important factor that you have within your environment, and you need to consider using a CMS. Now, CMS can it's from a security standpoint, it's holding the credentials, but it also can be a requirement based on the regulatory aspects that you may have within your company. They may be required to have a CMS to store the credentials of your identity and access management environment. So keep that in mind. So if you hear people talking about CMS, it is a credential storing, credential management system. Now, there's some basic components to that, but we're going to kind of roll into the deep dive around what are the pieces of it. But when you're dealing with the basic components of a CMS, you have a user enrollment, identity proofing, credential insurance, issuance, credential renewal, and then credential revocation. So if you walk through that, it makes sense, right? You enroll them, you sure that's who they are, you provide the credentials, you renew the credentials, and then you revoke the credentials. That's pretty basic, right? Those are the basic components. So when you're dealing with the components, let's do with identity provisioning. This deals with creating there's basically about eight different or nine different components as it associates with the CMS. There's identity provisioning. This provisions your identity, and this ties into Active Directory. It allows the credentials to be created and assigned, and it may also involve setting up the initial roles and the permissions for the user. The next one you have is authentication management. Now, this is responsible for verifying the identities of the individuals, kind of like the proofing, right? Identity proofing, which we talked about. This makes sure that who you say you are is who you are. This can be usernames and passwords. It could be biometric data associated with you. It could be other multi-factor authentication mechanisms that are tied into the authentication management piece of this. And a lot of this will depend upon what security's needs are for the organization. But you have identity provisioning, authentication management, and then you have authorization management. Now, authorization management is the user, just basically once the identity has been authenticated, right? So now you've proofed them. The CMS needs to determine what the user is allowed to do. What are the roles and permissions that the person can and cannot do? And that's tied to the authorizations. So Sean can gain access to this because I've identified who Sean is. I've confirmed it who he is. I have his information. And now Sean has access to X, Y, and Z. Then we look at the credential storage. Obviously, this is the secure storage of my credentials to ensure that if they were compromised, that's what secure means, what would happen? Can they gain access to my credentials? We see this a lot. Most hackers will go after the credential storage areas because why? They can then steal those credentials and utilize them in other places. Also, people reuse credentials a lot. So therefore, if I steal them from one place, odds are high they're going to log me into many other locations. But again, this needs to be a very secure location to prevent anybody that had unauthorized access. And this can involve using various encryption type techniques, hashing, salting, and encryption. That's a different section of the CISSP, but again, they can be done in various ways. Password management is another part. This is the creation, storage, and maintenance of the user passwords. And this is tied to the requirements you may have set up as it relates to complexity, rotation, history, etc. Next one is access management. This includes both giving physical and logical access to the resources. And this includes can set up controls in different parts of the building or network, depending on what you want to allow access into. Audit and compliance. Again, this is a way that your compliance folks can come back and look at the credentials, look at the logging and monitoring that was in place, and then did people have the right access? Did people log in when they were supposed to? Did people have the ability to gain access to these systems they shouldn't have? We've used these areas when we're trying to determine employee work ethics. Are they working a lot? Are they not working? Are they just working from home and they don't ever log in? You'll utilize the identity and access providers to help in those areas as well. Identity federation, this is for organizations that have multiple systems for third-party services. Again, this ties into SSO and using SAML and OpenID. That's the identity federation part of this. This is where you have a centralized management of identities is all pulled into this part of the CMS. And then lifecycle management. Again, this incorporates a user's credentials from creation to deletion. All of those are when your person gets to the company, they sign up their username and password, they log in, they're now in the system, they now leave the system, and then when they leave the system, how are those credentials removed from the environment? All right, that's all I have for today. I hope you guys have a wonderful day. It's been an amazing adventure talking to you today. And go check out CISSPcybertraining.com. Go check out the website. You got some really great stuff out there. Also, you can go to freecissp questions.com, and you can get access to free CISSP questions. You get 30 free questions each and every month that will be sent to you that you have access to. And so you can do that just by signing up for my emails. You'll also get access to various other CISSP related information just by being part of the CISSP cyber training community. All right. I hope you guys have a wonderful day, and we will catch you on the flip side. See ya. Thanks so much for listening today, as it was my pleasure to prep you for the CISSP exam. But are you interested in some free CISSP exam questions? Head on over to CISSPquestions.com and sign up to join my email list, and you will gain access to 30 free CISSP questions each and every month. That's a total of 360 questions just for signing up with CISSP Cyber Training. You will also gain access to other free resources, so just head on over to FreeCISSPquestions.com or CISSPcybertraining.com and sign up today. All right, have a wonderful day, and we'll catch you on the flip side. See ya.